You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
On the show, I have a special guest, which I'm really honored to have on, she's got an impressive resume. Her name is Dr. Natalie Newman, and she's a residency-trained, board-certified emergency physician who's been in practice for 22 years. So she's been on the front line of seeing all of the changes that have been coming down the pipe from, I guess, from you name it, from Obamacare back to HMOs, etc. She graduated in 1991 from California State University, and she has a degree in biological sciences. She attended the medical school at Case Western Reserve in Cleveland, Ohio, on an Army scholarship, and she graduated in 1995. She went into the ER medical residency in my neck of the woods in New York at North Shore University in Manhasset. And her first assignment on active duty after finishing her residency was at the Womack Army Medical Center in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. She was deployed to Bosnia, and she was chief of emergency department at Eagle Base in Tuzla, Bosnia. And she actually was one of the, well, was the only woman who was deployed over there. She has taken care of Queen Noor of Jordan, and she's got just done yeoman's work, and I think someone who can explain to us different aspects of our healthcare system. She's now working in private practice and in ER at an urgent care. So her journey has come, I would think, full circle from being from training, and I'm sure, like I did, old school training, where you actually have to spend time overnight and you don't leave until it's done kind of residency, to being on her own and working in an urgent care and seeing the front line of healthcare. It's not so much the private practice doctors who get to see the people who are out on the front line and who need our help. It's the people who show up in the urgent care. So I wanted to get her take on everything that's changed in our healthcare system. And one of the things that I'm really, really impressed with is the fact that you're not just talking about it, but you have started an organization, and I'd love you to tell our listeners more about how you made the transition to being an advocate for the doctors and the patient relationship. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, I'm happy to join you. Thank you so much for inviting me, Dr. George. And let's see, where's a good place to start? I have been practicing emergency medicine for 22 years, as you stated, and I did go through the training similar to yours, where there were no limitations at the time. So whenever I rotated through certain programs, such as internal medicine or surgery, we were required to be up all night and carry quite a few patients on our roster, and you didn't leave until you got done, just as you said. I do want to clarify one thing. I typically work in emergency departments that are attached to hospitals. Mm-hmm. However, after 22 years, I am winding down my career a little bit, and I'm now working in urgent cares, although I'm currently being credentialed to work in another ER. I work primarily part-time now.
Okay.
So I do both. I work in urgent cares, and I work in emergency departments still. The group that you're speaking of called Physicians for Patient Protection, I actually did not form that organization. That was formed by another physician but in March of this year, March 2017. I joined in August of 2017.
Gotcha.
Okay, so I just wanted to make that clarification as well. And it actually happened upon a group when I was invited into the group. And the changes I've seen over the years of, I love medicine. I love the art of medicine. I still love what I do. I just happen to think that medicine has become more of a business than it has of a clinical entity that it was when I began. It was mostly about the art of medicine. It's always been a business. However, it just seems more so now, in my opinion, and it's metric-driven, so patients And again, this is my opinion and not the opinion of PPP or the Physicians for Patient Protection, that they are kind of moved through the system pretty rapidly. So to give you an example, when I'm working in an emergency department, there are certain metrics called door-to-doc time, the time it takes for a patient to come into the ER to be seen by a physician, and then the amount of time that they are in the emergency department, there are tabs kept on that, and then there are tabs kept on the number of patients who leave without being seen. There's just variations. Every doctor has certain numbers, and they're kept on each physician, those numbers, and it places you more or less on a bell curve of where you fall with your colleagues, and it can determine whether or not you stay in a job. So that pressure sometimes takes precedence over the care to the patient when it should not. Mm-hmm. Not something we want to do intentionally, but like anybody, if you don't want to lose your job, sometimes you conform. And I think that's what it's become today. It's just difficult to see that it's come that far. Physicians for Patient Protection began out of concern about the physician shortage today and that gap being filled by mid-level providers. That is not a term that I made up, but a term that is typically used for billing purposes or identification purposes with Medicare or certain, you know, governmental entities. Mm-hmm. But made up of the mid-level practitioners are nurse practitioners and physician's assistants. They can also be called allied health professionals. And this position gap, the mid-level providers are considered an option for filling that gap. We disagree with that. We feel that to fill a position gap, you have to use a physician. About 8,000 medical students this year who graduated from medical school did not match into a residency. For those who don't understand what match means, it means that once you graduate medical school, you find a specialty or field that you would like to work in, you apply to a hospital to work in that particular field, and interview, and hopefully the hospital that you, one of the hospitals you interview at will select you for that program, and you're a match. Mm-hmm. 8,000 did not match. So there are 8,000 potential physicians sitting out there working in places like Walmart, Target, Starbucks, still trying to get into a residency program. Our PPP's position is why don't we use those potential physicians who have already graduated medical school and have their MD license, why can't we use them to fill the position gap in a more creative way, in another position that may be created where they can continue their training until they can get into a residency, but still be able to work as a physician who supervised.
That makes sense.
We just think that there are other options to be creative. Number two about the shortage, there's also an extremely severe nursing shortage. So as more of these nurses transfer into their becoming nurse practitioners, the bedside nurse, the population of bedside nurses shrinks. Working in a hospital, that experience to me has been that some of the floors, when we admit patients to certain floors, are closed because there aren't enough nurses to care for them. So it impacts medicine tremendously when we lose a valuable bedside nurse. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, 20-something years ago, when I began practicing, I learned from these old seasoned nurses who've been practicing 25, 30 years. They knew their stuff, so to speak. But the practice of nursing and the practice of medicine are two very different things. Medicine is medicine, nursing is nursing. However, they complement each other. But one does not replace the other. It is our contingent. It is our perspective, PPP's perspective, that we're being replaced by these mid-level practitioners because they're cheaper to hire. That's our ultimate, one of our beliefs. And it is. It is to save money for the hospitals and for the corporations. But in the long run, it doesn't save money because many times a lot of patients who were being seen by these mid-level practitioners are sent to various physicians or consults inappropriately. They're given inappropriate referrals, or they're mismanaged. It is hard to document these instances because there's not many people keeping track. However, we are seeing those patients when we receive those patients. For instance, if I get them in the ER because they've been mismanaged, or a colleague may see them in endocrinology or neurology, and or particularly psychiatry, where a patient is on too many psychiatric medications that could be deadly. The educational level is not the same. As you know, being a physician, the training is hugely expensive, and it's a very long process. There is no shortcut to becoming a physician. I don't want to sound elitist. I do believe that both fields, nursing and medicine, are complementary, but we do work in the same environment, so they appear to be the same, but they are not the same, and that if one is going to practice as a physician, then one needs to go to medical school. I cannot practice as a nurse without going to nursing school. And so we believe that there's only one path to being a physician, and that's the path of medical school, and that there should be no other option outside of that. And the nurse practitioners have advanced educations, they have master's degrees, and there are some programs that are doctorates. Many of these programs, by the way, are online programs, maybe requiring anywhere from 500 to 1,500 hours of clinical training. That clinical training consists of shadowing, which is basically working with a physician and observing what they do, as opposed to residency, where we are actually the ones having to manage the patient under close supervision and on a tightrope. Mm-hmm. Residents are not left to practice unsupervised for a minimum of 7 years. 4 years of medical school, 3 years, 3 to 7 years of residency. So a minimum of 7 years is required before we are allowed to actually manage a patient on our own. That is not the same with nurse practitioners or physician's assistants. The training is a lot less, and then once they finish their training, they can go and practice basically seeing patients without the level of clinical training we have had. That's concerning to us as well. It may look like you're practicing medicine when you're not actually practicing medicine. And that's what's scary to me.
To me as well. You know, I know you said so much and such a mouthful. I want to take, you know, highlight some of these things that you said so people really understand. This is not a joke. This is not something you can just wing and and do it online, never touch a patient, not do anatomy, not do physiology in the same, you know, not understanding a disease process, but you're on the front line writing prescriptions and they want to give, you know, reciprocity to writing narcotics, and you just, we need to tease this out. So let's take a break and come back and go through in more detail because I'm fascinated. Thank you. You're listening to Medicine on Call.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare, but for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
This is Lawyer Liz. Join me each week as we discuss drones, the Internet of Things, and all the technology in between. It's Buzz Off with Lawyer Liz, Wednesdays at 2.
Understanding health insurance is becoming more challenging. If you currently have insurance, you probably notice that it costs more to see your doctor. And if you're able to keep your doctor, it takes longer to get an appointment. The bad news is, this trend is projected to continue. Your costs will likely continue to rise, while your healthcare choice and access will continue to fall. The good news is, Peachtree ENT Center has the answer to this problem. We believe in taking care of the whole patient, because healing is more than writing a prescription. We are committed to working with you, and we specialize in providing affordable care for patients without insurance, those who are underinsured, and those with high deductibles or catastrophic coverage. And we offer same-day appointments. You no longer have to choose between staying healthy and paying bills, because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Good morning. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. We're having a really important conversation with Dr. Natalie Newman, an emergency medicine physician and also a member of Physicians for Patient Protection. Am I saying that right?
That's correct.
Excellent. You know, before the break, at the beginning of your synopsis of where we stand now, you said something that really blew my mind, that there are 8,000, you know, medical doctors out there who cannot practice. My question is, who's filling those spots? Are we getting doctors coming from foreign countries coming into the residency programs, and they're taking them instead of American-trained physicians? Why are there that many people out of a job? Can you answer that?
Well, I received those statistics from the National Registry, the matching program,
right.
The NRMP.
Right.
And it is a combined number. So it is the number of medical students who are graduating, who were to begin their PGY 1 year, their first year of residency.
Right.
Some are students who have returned perhaps from a sabbatical, maybe after medical school, took 1 or 2 years off.
Mm-hmm.
It is Canadian graduates and foreign medical graduates. It's a combination.
Okay.
Out of those numbers, the majority are American students.
Okay.
And the problem is that it's not that they just didn't match, is that there are not enough residency spots, which is a whole nother subject that we can save for another time. But there are way more medical schools than there are residency slots. So it's almost as if it's designed for students to go to medical school knowing that a certain percentage will never, ever get into a residency. And the further the amount of time spent sitting out there without a residency, the longer you are without a residency, the harder it is to get in. So if you can't get into a residency in 2 years, the likelihood of you getting in the third year apply is very low.
Wow.
And that's not their fault. They may be doing all the right things. There's just not enough slots, and it becomes more difficult as time goes on. We think that they should have other options. We have ideas, Physicians for Patient Protection, that we think would work better.
I mean, that's an amazing idea. Imagine being seen by an MD in the ER. Well, this is another thing I question about, because I'm an independent doctor now. I don't have any really dealings with ERs anymore, unless I'm doing locum tenens, which has been a while. But
right.
Who's the front line? I mean, when I left locum tenens positions, there were a lot of PAs calling consults to me, and not a lot of ER doctors, MDs. And am I wrong? Is that been a change in the workforce there as well, where the PAs are the front line and the nurses are the front line, and then the physicians are overseers there as well?
It is. It has been happening, and that is one of the changes, the landscape that has changed that I don't like. Physician's assistants have always been in ERs since I've begun,
mm-hmm.
22 years ago. They were always there. Matter of fact, my first time I sutured anything, which was a hand, I was taught by a physician's assistant. There's a place for physician's assistants. There's a place for nurse practitioners. However, in the ER, there was a section called the fast track. That was typically people that you would see, say, in an urgent care that are less emergent,
mm-hmm.
maybe a cut to the hand, maybe a sprained ankle or a simple upper respiratory infection. These people were managed by the physician's assistants. And by the way, when physician's assistants go to their programs, the PA programs, once they graduate and get their license, they fall under the auspices of the medical board, just as physicians do. Whatever state they practice in, they're under the medical board. Nurse practitioners remain under the nursing board.
Okay.
And there's a big difference. There's a big distinction with that that we can also talk about later. But, yes, the you're correct about the landscape changing regarding the number of people who call or the type of provider who would call you for consults.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I would work with a PA and they would call a doctor and the doctor was adamant about speaking to another physician. They absolutely would not speak to the PA. That has changed, and it was a bit elitist or discriminatory, but I understand the perspective because if you're ENT, if I'm calling about somebody with a complicated abscess in the back of their throat, mm-hmm. you may ask me specific questions. I can answer those questions because I understand the pathophysiology of disease. Mid-levels don't have that depth of training, and they don't have the depth of training when it comes to pharmacological management or medical or management requiring medication. As you know, when we train, you get that ad nauseum for obvious reasons because you're managing human beings with complex systems. So I understood why these physicians would demand to speak to another doctor because they would have a lot of questions before they either came in. And if they're going to come in and do surgery on somebody, they want to know what's going on in a little bit more detail other than this person has this disorder.
Yeah, or a sore throat, you know. I'm with you. I'm one of those doctors who's been called
in. You're meticulous.
Uh-huh.
You're meticulous. So my feeling is this. They can call for a consult, but if a doctor asks to speak to another physician, that should be honored. Now, their reasons may vary, but we're talking about the patient. We should never, ever, ever forget that the patient is number one. And our mantra, Physicians for Patient Protection, is patients first, always. So if that doctor wants to speak to me, I will speak to that physician. Mm-hmm. I will not have an issue with that.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's more confrontational. The physician's assistants back then weren't as defensive. I think as I've seen the change in emergency medicine, it's one of the reasons I stopped supervising mid-level practitioners 2 years ago because it became unsafe. I felt that many were practicing as if they were practicing unsupervised, and they work under the physician's license, at least in about 23 states. 22 states they're allowed to practice unsupervised. That is well. Without the direct supervision of a physician. We're unhappy with that as well, physician PPP, but that's been done. That's something that's already done and completed, but we don't agree with it. We think they should always remain supervised by a physician because some patients appear simple who are not, and you've probably seen that as well in your specialty. So
absolutely.
It has changed, and because they are cheaper to hire, more and more are working in the emergency department. What I never ever thought I would see is I never thought I would see a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant seeing a patient who was what we call a priority one or two, life-threatening emergencies. Somebody coming in with a heart attack or a stroke, being managed by these patients. I remember working in one particular hospital, and while I was suturing the patient's finger, the physician assistant was managing a patient with chest pain. And I said, there's something wrong with this picture because I'm the one with the most expertise and I'm the one who's doing the supervision. Why am I suturing the finger and this person managing the chest pain? It should be the opposite because the patients expect the best when they come to the ER. They expect the best care. It's not that the mid-level practitioners, I'm going to start saying MLPs because that's a mouthful. It's not that they're not good at what they do. Everybody has a role on the healthcare team, and those are vital roles. But they are roles that we must remain in. You have to stay in your lane because I can't do what everybody else does if I'm not trained in that particular field. But I can work alongside you so that we can do what's best for the patient. And I feel like that's changed. I feel as if we're being replaced and for cheaper labor, to be frank, and there are primary care physicians, as we speak today, who are losing jobs to nurse practitioners, not because the work is necessarily better, but because medicine is a business, and what is the purpose of a business? To make a profit. How do you increase that profit? You hire cheaper labor. That's one of the processes one can follow. This is no different. And we maintain that that's not good enough when you're talking about human beings. It's unacceptable. And so in the ER, yes, you do see quite a bit of that, where you might have one or two doctors and more mid-levels working. And I'm not in agreement with that either, but there is a shortage of physicians. So I say, let's take those medical students that graduated, put them in a program that's not yet been developed yet, and use them, utilize them. They still have more of the knowledge base than a nurse practitioner or PA would. There's no online medical school, with the exception of Oceana University. There is one online medical school, but they have to do their clinicals in a hospital setting and do a rotation just like we did as medical students.
Well, I have
so
a question.
That part is not replaceable. Yeah, I was surprised to find out there was one online medical school. Very surprised. And it's legitimately accredited, but a lot of the students have obviously a very difficult time getting into residencies in the United States, but there are residencies that have accepted some of those students.
What?
Not many, hardly at all, but there are some who've been successful in getting in because they do have that last two years that we would have in medical school, and they have to do the same thing we did when we trained traditionally. What's different is the first 2 years, theirs is online didactic, whereas ours was in a brick-and-mortar building.
Well, I have a question. Compare that to the training of a physician assistant. How long is their training? If ours is a minimum of 7, what's theirs?
You mean compared to a physician?
Yeah.
PA?
Yeah.
The PA, 4 years of college, 2 years of PA school. Physician, 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, a minimum of 3 years of residency, up to 7 years of residency. We're not counting the college part, just after college,
yeah.
You're comparing a minimum of 7 years to 2 years.
So how can they be trained for neurology, neurosurgery? I mean, the 2 years doesn't get that. I mean, neurosurgeon is what? 10 years for that, 6 years for ENT. How does that work?
Neurosurgery can. Yeah, you're right.
I mean, no, I'm just saying. There's no way that these guys with 2 years can end up, and they're ending up in the same thing that doctors do: subspecialties, surgical
right.
subs, GI. You know, things that they're not family practice for the most part. They're coming into
right.
the specialty side,
right.
and they're doing. I mean, when I first came out of residency, I worked at a huge group. And the PA was called doctor. The patient didn't even know the PA was not a doctor. But they were doing everything, scoping the patient, spraying the patient. It took me, as any ENT, and I'm sure any other specialist, to know what I was looking at, the experience to know when I scope somebody what I was looking for. I just don't think that that's the same thing. And a doctor's coming in and signing off on the chart, but not performing the exam. I mean, this whole system is not kosher. I mean, it's like this conveyor belt. You have the
right.
the tech taking the vitals. You've got the nurse coming in and going over the thing with the patient. The doctor comes in after everybody does the work, looks it over, and then pronounces, writes a prescription. No one's really seeing the patient. The how can I put it? The least experienced person is on the front line of care. It's bad enough when it's in office, but I can't even imagine how unsafe that might be in an ER setting.
Well, first of all, let me say, this is not a bashing.
No, it's
listening.
Just...
I'm not bashing nurse practitioners.
Neither am I.
I'm not bashing MLP or physician's assistants at all. Like I said many times, there's a role for them on the healthcare team and always has been. They were there before I even began my training.
Mm-hmm.
And I've worked with excellent ones, particularly when I was in the Army. So I have no issue with them working anywhere. What we have to understand is that the patients don't know who is treating them. PPP believes in truth in advertising. They have a right to know who's managing them. Yes, there are people who look like they're doing what the doctor is doing, so naturally the patient will assume that that is the physician, and that's wrong. that's just wrong, because when there's a complication or an issue, they have to know that it was done by someone who did not have as much training as a physician. No one's saying that anyone is better, but as you know, you and I are held accountable for the patient ultimately. Mm-hmm. I don't care who we work with. Whoever we work with, the doctor is always considered the head of that team and the one with the most expertise, because we do have the most training, and that is as it should be. So you cannot water it down. I honestly, from a personal standpoint, I feel like medicine is being watered down in that sense, because when you're talking about gastroenterology, no, there's no residency for physicians assistants or nurse practitioners. Nurse practitioners and the physician assistants may do some shadowing, mm-hmm. or rotating through a doctor's office, a gastroenterologist's office, and work with them on certain procedures and get more extensive training on the job. I see it more like an apprenticeship.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can go and practice independently, some of them. Now, PAs have not been able to practice independently, mainly because 2 years is difficult for that to get approved, and their organization, their umbrella organization, is not in agreement with that. The belief system still is you must work under the supervision of a physician. If you want to practice independently, then you are not part of this organization for physician's assistants. Nurse practitioner is a whole different other animal, and the nurse practitioner, it's the AANP. I forgot exactly what the acronym stands for, but it's an umbrella organization for the nurse practitioners. They're extremely powerful. They're a lobby, and they're extremely powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And they do believe that the nurse practitioners can work independently after a certain amount of time, and they can go out and open their own office, call themselves dermatologists or pediatricians, using hijacking medical terms. Instead of saying a pediatric nurse practitioner,
right,
they're saying pediatrician.
That's not right.
It's not right.
No.
It's dishonest, and it's not truth in advertising. When PPP sees these ads, we contact them directly, and we tell them, you either change that or we will report you, because that is misleading. It depends from state to state if it's illegal, and they cannot misrepresent themselves. In most states, that is illegal. You cannot misrepresent yourself as a physician. But if you don't have to say, I'm a physician, you can just say, I'm a dermatologist. And that doesn't mean they're saying they're physicians. They may say in tiny little writing, nurse practitioner.
Wow.
But most people don't know what a nurse practitioner is. So they assume a dermatologist, that must be a doctor, and they go to that office. And we have a huge issue with that. And as an aside, I just want to state that there is a bill in the House, the Truth in Advertising bill, that was sponsored by Larry Bouchon, who's a Republican congressman from Indiana, and PPP is in full support of that bill. He is a cardiothoracic surgeon, and he believes that a patient has a right to know who's treating them, and it's as simple as that, and we're in agreement with that. So that's actually being addressed. He wants that nationwide, that everybody be identified on the healthcare team by a badge of who they are, so the patient knows, and there's no guessing.
Makes sense to me.
Yes, but that didn't used to be the case. We didn't have to do that. People were truthful when... Back 20-something years ago when I practiced, if a patient called a physician's assistant or a nurse practitioner or a doctor, they corrected them. They would say, I'm not the physician, I'm the nurse practitioner. Now they're not doing that. They're allowing the patient to think that that's who they are, and for stating, I can do what a physician can do. And I'm saying, you can't do what I can do because you haven't had my training. You can't do what I can do, but you look like you can do what I can do. But you're not doing what I've been trained to do, and that's misleading.
Well, I think you said
yes. I have the same problem you do with them working in specialties independently, but the doctors are complicit in that as well, because they allow this to happen when they're not directly there supervising this, and they're not clarifying to the patient and saying, this is a nurse practitioner who is working with me. And so the patient goes into surgery thinking that the doc's doing the surgery part of the surgery, when it's actually a mid-level practitioner. And that's dishonest. But doctors are partially complicit for the situation we're in today. It's not just them being aggressive, the MLPs. It's us allowing it to happen for many reasons.
Well, I think we need to also look at the hospitals and
yes.
sham peer review. I thank goodness I'm not on a staff where I have to take order from a medical executive committee, but their power is tremendous. And if you and I actually left the a staff of a hospital because I felt that my license was at risk. They were allowing a call center to admit ENT patients from various hospitals across the state without mm-hmm. contacting the doctor on call. So you were in the position of being on the hook to see a patient that may be outside of your scope of practice. And
because
of EMTALA, if you don't see the person, hey, you're on up the creek. But
right.
And then once you see the person, let's say it's an airway emergency, you have to stabilize the patient and find another doctor in another hospital to accept them. Good luck with that. I just saw that was just crazy, and I left. But I can imagine if you had a question about a nurse practitioner, or something going on in your hospital where you felt, hey, this is not right, who could you go to? You would probably be seen as a problem, a peer review would be, you know, your hostile work environment. I can see all sorts of things that would work against you for speaking up. So I think it's a combination of it's just easier to keep your head down, not get it shot off. And whoever has the money, whoever
right.
controls the pocketbook has the power. This is the mistake I believe that doctors have made.
Yes.
Becoming an employee of an entity that could give a damn. All they want is your labor. They want the cachet of having you on staff, but they don't want to treat you like a professional. Now it's gotten completely out of control. And the patients are the one, as you said, are on the hook. They don't know. And the patient just wants to come in and get better. That's all they want. But I've actually talked to nurses on the other side. You know, the old school nurses, the ones that we learn
yeah.
from? They left the profession. I don't feel safe. I don't want this outside of my comfort zone.
That's right.
I mean, they were in the ICU for years and years and being asked to put in lines and take care of patients. They became the intensivist. That's crazy. And they walked into private practice. They do other things in ambulatory surgery centers now. That's a loss
That's right.
to the patient. You know, do you want someone who's been trained for 2 years to put in a Swan-Ganz, which is a huge catheter, you know, you have a really sick, complicated patient without a doctor in there? I mean, that's crazy.
Well, you know, what's even more crazy is that there are actually nurse practitioners managing children in the pediatric intensive care unit.
What?
They're pediatric intensive care unit nurse practitioners.
Oh, my God. Not a neonatologist?
There are ICUs that are fully managed by mid-level practitioners. It pisses me off, I'll be frank, because the patients don't know this. If the patients knew, if you have a child and you're in the ICU, it doesn't mean they're not providing care, but if you have one doctor or two doctors, it's not like a ratio. It's not like one doctor to one nurse practitioner and they're being supervised.
Mm-hmm.
They may all be answering to one physician, but that physician may not actually be present. The other thing that annoys me is that because I'm in a forum, a closed forum of another organization, I do have residents who speak to me and they complain in emergency medicine that the mid-levels are, and the nurse practitioners and PAs are being given procedures over them.
What?
Like they have to compete to do procedures. So you went to a surgical specialty. So there's gads and gads of procedures that you have to learn before you can go out and practice as an ENT doc.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now imagine if you were that resident and you have to compete with a nurse practitioner and a PA for the same procedure when you're the one who's going to be supervising some of them when you graduate. I was incensed when I learned this from the residents. They're like, I have to fight for a procedure because they're giving them all away to the MLPs. I said, how is that possible? What does your program director say about this? They say nothing.
What?
When it's become the norm, it looks like the norm. When it's wrong. And I don't even know where to begin. Right now, we're just trying to fight for the patient so that the patient knows who's treating them and that they get managed by the appropriate people in the right way, and it's the healthcare team. This is a whole nother animal, and it just feels like there is an octopus with a bunch of tentacles out there, and it bothers me that the patients don't know. When I speak about it to my family and friends, they're shocked. Because they said, well, how did it get to this point? And I said, well, doctors are partially complicit in this, and I think burnout is a big part. And when the mid-levels were always willing to step up and do things when we got tired. and they started taking over these procedures, and we allowed it to happen. And I saw it happening in ER. I actually did work in one hospital. Now, I want to clarify, I've never actually been officially fired. However, if you get taken off the schedule, it amounts to the same thing, correct?
Yeah.
And I worked in one hospital where I was actually on a committee, and my job was to change the guidelines for physician's assistants in that hospital. When I came into the hospital, an incident had happened right before I arrived as a new physician working there, that a PA had attempted to do a spinal tap on a three-week-old baby in the emergency department. He couldn't get the tap. He called the patient's doctor, a pediatrician in the community, to come in and do the tap. Instead of going to the ER doc who's supposed to be supervising him in that ER, he actually called the pediatrician.
What?
And that, he should have gone to the ER doc.
Yeah.
And that may have been because he didn't want the doc to know that he didn't know what he was doing.
Oh my goodness.
That happens, too, when you're not being honest with your supervising physician because you don't want to look stupid or that you don't know what you're doing. So he called this pediatrician. Pediatrician asked the right question, why are you doing the tap? Why mm-hmm. is the physician doing the tap? And the PA said, because I can do it. And that just blew everything sky high because the pediatrician raised holy, as you know.
Oh.
I'll leave the four-letter word out.
I can imagine.
And the hospital said, and it turned out that in their bylaws, it was very clear that PAs were not allowed to do procedures on infants that young. So they were violating their own bylaws when this PA was doing it, and they didn't even know it, because how many of us know the bylaws back and forth?
Yeah, those bylaws are long. It's a tome.
It's considered like a state law. It is not a joke. And it was, and so the director, sweating bullets, asked if anyone wanted to be on a committee, and I said, I want to be on it. So I was on it, and the committee spoke about the boundaries, and what I did was I extended their procedural skills where they could do more suturing, maybe some more complex suturing with the close supervision of a doctor. They would have to be signed off after so many, so many processes, and so on. And then I took it back to my department and got and submitted the proposal to all of my colleagues and to the mid-levels who work there and said, give me any of your feedback and let me know what you may disagree with so we can discuss it. Nobody really had a big issue with what I had proposed. So when the committee met, we voted, and it was changed and placed into the hospital bylaws. Then a new company came in, new ER group came in, took over the ER from the group that I had been working in, and they started to practice the way that was not following the bylaws. And so the PAs were not allowed to pick up patients who were level 1 and 2, critical patients. They were absolutely not. They could pick up level 3s, but they had to present them to a physician. They could pick up 4 and 5 patients, which are like the simple, easy patients. They could present the patient to the doctor if they felt necessary, but the doctor had to review that chart and sign it before they left for home. And that's how it was set up. When I had a PA, when I was working, she picked up a patient in diabetic ketoacidosis, a deadly condition, without telling me, and then mismanaged the patient, which could have resulted in the patient's brain swelling and killing them. When she presented the patient to me, who I did not know was in the emergency department, I asked her, why did you pick up that patient when you know you're not supposed to pick up level 1s? And she answered me, that's why I'm talking to you about the patient. She got snarky. So I just took the chart out of her hand, and I went and managed the patient. I'm not going to get into an argument because she's working under my license. If that patient had died, I would have been answering for it as well as her. She was a year out of PA school.
Wow.
And so then I got talked to by the regional director of the group I worked for, who said we all have to get along and blah, blah, blah. And I frankly told him, I said, you're a physician like I am, and you know that she shouldn't be managing patients like that, and it's in the bylaws. The next week, I was off the schedule, never heard from them again. That was it.
You know what? It's a blessing, because you might be staring at something else if you had stayed in that position, I think. You know, it's not healthy.
Oh, well, I put them on, I'm like them on white on rice. It doesn't matter what the supervision says. You can lecture me all day long. I work under my own license, and I feel that way when I work in any ER. When I get hired, I tell them, patients first, documentation second, speed third. That's how I work. And if a PA or mid-level is going to work with me, I'm on you like white on rice. And if you don't like it, then you have to go work with another physician. The powers that be can come and talk to me. It's not going to change my practice. I tell them the same thing. well, that makes some directors uncomfortable, but they understand that I'm following it. I've never had a peer review. I have never had a risk management case. I've never had any issue in a hospital with my clinical skills. Any issues may have been because I hurt someone's feelings because I was working as a physician. As far as I'm concerned, when I'm in an emergency department, all of those patients are my patients, even if there are other doctors working, because if they're not available, I have to step in.
I love it.
Maybe that doctor had to go do something. Maybe they're in the cafeteria getting something to eat and one of their patients is crashing. Well, the doctor who's there has to take over. That patient has to be cared for by somebody, and that would be the person with the highest level of expertise, which would be me. So, yes, I'm going to be on you like white on rice until I see that you know what you're doing, but you're going to tell me about those patients because that's your job, so that we're in agreement on how the patient's being managed, because the patients expect no less.
On
and
that,
all the people who are making these new rules now that are allowing them to practice this way, I can guarantee you that the corporate powers that be all have physicians as their primary provider. They don't have a nurse practitioner or a PA, but the legislators who are passing these laws and allowing this to happen do not all have physicians as their care, you know, the people caring for them and their families, which is very hypocritical.
It's not unusual. On that note, let's take a break. You're listening to
Absolutely.
Medicine on Call.
Do you have problems with sinus pain and pressure?
Do
other people smell things that you don't?
Capitol Hill.
Have you lost the joy in eating because food just doesn't taste like it used to? Is your nose always stuffy no matter what you do? Maybe you have sinus or nasal polyps. These are generally benign growths that occur from chronic sinus infection or allergies that are either undertreated or have not been treated at all. At Peachtree ENT Center, we specialize in minimally invasive balloon dilation sinus surgery and correction of deviated nasal septum and turbinate reduction surgery that can be done in the office. We use the state-of-the-art equipment so that you can see the problem. You will be a partner in your care, and together we will decide the course of treatment. We believe in old-fashioned medicine, where we take the time to fix the problem, not just medicate the symptoms. You can rest assured that all options will be offered before surgery is recommended, because Peachtree ENT Center is where patient care counts.
They could be going to rural hospitals.
Did you miss the show that you really wanted to hear?
They know a
All
lot.
All of our
just
programs
you
are available
do the,
for download
the residency to be
on AmericasWebRadio.com and on
crazy.
iTunes. Yeah. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Affordable health insurance was the promise
it's
of Obamacare,
and now it's
but for many,
driven,
the government
so
mandate caused more problems
do,
than it solved.
It
this is Dr. Leah George from Medicine on Call,
they
and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under
and
Obamacare,
Liberty HealthShare. Well
Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom
easy.
To choose,
don't go to
and with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
Don't know anything.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Good morning. Welcome back to Medicine on Call. Before the break, you said a lot of things that I want to just, because we only have 10 minutes left, but I definitely want to go over a little bit more detail. Who has, if a nurse practitioner or nursing mid-level takes care of a patient and there's a bad outcome, we know the PAs are under the medical license. What happens to the nurses if something happens untoward? Who's responsible? Will they get sued or will the doctor get sued?
Well, typically a lawyer, you sue whoever is in the chain of that patient's care, and then you can be dropped later if you determine not to really be culpable. That's kind of how it works. So everybody who saw that patient from the time they hit the door until the patient died or the incident happened and is get sued. That's generally how it works. So, yes, but if you're supervising, yes, we're part of that lawsuit. And I've not been part of a lawsuit like that personally, although I was told by an attorney when I was called to testify for a patient who was assaulted, and I said I never saw the patient. My PA saw that patient, and I documented clearly that I never saw or evaluated the patient. He said, it doesn't matter. You're the MD on the chart.
Wow.
And that's how they look at it. You are the MD on the chart. We're going to go after you also. And this was just as a witness. This is just me being a witness, not even being sued. So that is the perspective. And I did want to clarify something about that I heard you guys speaking about a little bit when you talk about the MLPs going to the rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
PPP has found that that's actually not true. They work in urban and suburban areas just like most physicians do. We have a lot of these statistics, which I can get to you or one of my colleagues can get to you when you speak to them in the future to give you these numbers. But that's falsity. They are not working more in the rural areas compared to physicians. We're out there, too. I'm a doc who works primarily in rural areas, and I'm ER. We're out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just misleading because they're saying, well, doctors don't want to work out there. They don't get to pay the same money. Mm-hmm. I negotiate my pay. If they can pay a CEO, they can pay me.
Mm-hmm.
And you go where there's a need, where I'm getting credential right now, mm-hmm. is in a rural hospital that's doctor only. There are no mid-levels mm-hmm. at that particular hospital. So it's misleading to say that. And,
well, that's
and
good.
It looks makes them look more altruistic that's where they're going when nobody else wants to go there. They are there in primary care, and that part is true, because we have a shortage of primary care physicians. But I'm saying they're not physicians, that if you want to fill the gap, fill it with a physician and get one of those 8,000 medical students, put them in the rural area under the supervision of a primary care doctor in the region, and let them take care of the patient.
That would be an amazing thing for patients out there, instead of depending on things like telemedicine. And,
right.
you know, it's just whatever they can do to kind of just do the minimum while they, you know, and I'm talking about the medical system at this point, because it seems to have shifted towards what can we get away with? What's the minimum that we need to
right.
do to
You're
charge
right.
out the yin yang? And it's just not, the value isn't
the
there.
Exactly. The shortcut. And I said, there's no shortcut from being a physician. There's no shortcut. If you take a shortcut, the patient gets cut short.
Yeah.
And do you want that to be your family member? And if you're okay with that, you have that choice. There are people who prefer to see nurse practitioners. That's their choice. All we're saying is let them know their options. Okay? But don't say that you're me and you can do what I can do. Don't do that. That's dishonest. Because you can't do what I can do. You don't have the depth of training that I have. And that's not being arrogant. That's just a fact. And there's a reason we're trained at that level.
I think you said...
We have a huge responsibility. The patients... We're in America. There's a reason we have the best medicine in the world. Because we did not settle for less. We raised our standard of care in the early 1900s when the AMA hired Mr. Dr. Flexner to do a study on the best medical schools in the nation so that we can have a standardized system to up the skills of physicians, the Flexner Report.
Mm-hmm.
And we did that. And our model was Johns Hopkins Hospital. That's who he used as the model. And that's what all the medical schools are based on. And they did that because they wanted standardization so that the quality of care would be better, and it worked. There are a lot of inventions that have been happening in medicine as a result from scientists and physicians. There's a lot of good. We do have the best medicine in the world. And now you want to take shortcuts. And why try to fix something that's not broken in that sense? And my other issue is just don't try to fill a physician gap with a non-physician. Stop talking about that when there are physicians out there sitting, potential physicians, with no residency. Open up more residency so we can get those doctors out there and fill that gap with them. They're there. And then let the nurses fill the nursing shortage.
What is the AMA saying about this? Because this is like no-brainer.
The AMA has said that they should not ever be unsupervised. They've made a bold stance that nurse practitioners must not ever practice unsupervised. Once you're unsupervised, you're out there, as far as we are concerned, practicing medicine without a license, because you're under the nursing board. The nursing board does not hold them accountable in the same way the medical board does. Wow. Not by any stretch of the imagination. Nursing board is more lax. That's why the nurses don't want to be under the medical board, because it is incredibly strict. So they say we're practicing advanced nursing. But yet you open up a practice saying that you're a dermatologist and that you did residency and that you have your board certification and this practice. Hijacking medical terms that doctors use, but you're a nurse practitioner practicing advanced nursing. That is not truth in advertising. That is lying, and that is being intentionally misleading. And that's wrong. And that's what PPP is fighting. Be proud that you're a nurse. Say that you're a nurse and use the appropriate language that identifies you as a nurse, and let the patient make the decision.
I think you said something, again, that's really important. And it's not about, again, it's not about bashing anybody. It's about, as you said, truth in advertising and letting patients know what the difference is so that they can make an informed choice. And I agree with you. There'll be people who want to do telemedicine. There'll be people who want to see a nurse practitioner who don't mind seeing a PA, want it. But that's right. What we really need to, you know, are you the only professional group that's taking this tact on this? Because again, I'm not an AMA member, but I haven't heard a thing from them in terms of scope of practice and what's going on the front line.
Oh, no, there's a larger group than us called Physicians Working Together. Where I met you in D.C., they were there also. And we work they've been around longer than us. And I can't speak on their group because I'm not a member of that, although we work because our group is new.
Mm-hmm.
But we were there together to speak about that topic, and they are a much bigger group than us. We have about 4,000 in our group. They have way more thousands than that. And we are in agreement with the Truth in Advertising Bill. We support that, and we don't believe that mid-level should be practicing unsupervised. Mm-hmm. So, yes, there are other groups that existed before us that are also fighting this. They're aggressive. So it's very similar, but our philosophies may vary as far as our ultimate goals and the type of issues we address. But right now we're both addressing this issue because we fight bills that are put up in the legislature where they're proposing to practice unsupervised. I don't like the word independent. Independent suggests that you're dependent on me and now you want to be independent. Mm-hmm. I say no, you're supervised by me and you want to be unsupervised to do your own thing so that no one can see what you're doing. And we don't want unsupervised practice. We're against it.
On that note, we're coming to the end of the show and I have to have you back on because this is such an important topic. I think we just scratched the surface.
Yes.
Is there a way that people can contact you or your organization, that patients can get involved and actually be educated? Is there something like that that patients should know about?
Well, we are developing a website at this point. We do have a handout that we give to individuals in person called Know Your Doctor, and it explains all the educational levels of different fields, including optometry, podiatry, naturopathy, PA, nurse practitioner, physicians. It summarizes all of that. But because we're a fledgling organization, we don't yet have a website. We are developing it, and then we will promote it.
Well, I want to have you back on so that we can...
Absolutely.
As every step as this continues to grow, and thank you so much for your time. You're just
thank
a blessing.
Thank you for inviting me, and you have a nice day.
Thank you. You too.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to Medicine on Call.
Affordable health insurance was the promise of Obamacare, but for many, the government mandate caused more problems than it solved. This is Dr. Elena George from Medicine on Call, and I want to tell you about a truly affordable alternative allowed under Obamacare, Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare bypasses doctor and hospital panels, giving you the freedom to choose. And with a maximum of $500 out-of-pocket per person and 100% coverage up to $1 million per year per occurrence, you can rest assured knowing you and your family are protected. Coverage starts as low as $107 per month and also includes dental, vision, pharmacy, and holistic care. Liberty HealthShare puts you back in charge of your health. Visit them online at libertyoncall.org. Again, for a true affordable alternative to Obamacare, visit libertyoncall.org or call toll-free 1-800-714-6993 today.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.